Penguin Random House Audio presents A World in Disarray, American Foreign Policy and the Crisis of the Old Order by Richard Haas. Read for you by Dan Warren. Introduction read by the author.
This book is dedicated to my teachers, Robert Tufts, Tom Frank, Albert Hirani, Alistair Bakken, and Michael Howard. Forward, this is Richard Haas. A World in Disarray concludes with the chapter, A Country in Disarray. The 2016 presidential campaign, which ended after this book was completed, underscored this judgment by highlighting multiple divisions within American society that are both long-standing and deep. One result of the election is greater uncertainty over the future trajectory of U.S. foreign policy. As the subtitle of this book suggests, support for the old order has crumbled, the result of heightened economic anxiety at home, often associated with globalization, free trade, and immigration, and growing doubts about the costs and benefits associated with what the United States has been doing abroad, including fighting several open-ended wars in the Middle East and supporting allies in Europe and Asia. It is significant that Donald Trump, the winning candidate, called for putting America first. The rest of the world has taken note. Assumptions about the willingness of the United States to continue doing what it has been doing in the world are being questioned as never before by friends, foes, and everyone in between. All this, along with an inbox best described as daunting in the quantity and quality of the challenges filling it, is what awaits the 45th president, who, like his predecessors, will enjoy great latitude in matters of national security. It is, of course, impossible to know what sort of foreign policy will emerge from the United States and how other countries and entities will react. Still, it is difficult not to take seriously the possibility that one historical era is ending and another beginning. Introduction. On June 23, 2016, a narrow majority of those British citizens who went to the polls voted in favor of a referendum that called for an end to their country's membership in the European Union. Those voting for Brexit may have wanted to voice their frustration with low levels of economic growth, anger over immigration, fears of unemployment, or unhappiness with a portion of their taxes going to an institution based in Brussels that often seem remote in order to support countries that often seem to be profligate. Some voters may simply have wanted to register a protest against the politicians ruling their country. But whatever the motives, the results were profound, affecting not just the future of the United Kingdom and Europe, but that of the United States and the entire world as well. If Brexit actually happens, depending on its terms, it could lead to the breakup of the United Kingdom and a partial unraveling of the EU. If this was to occur, the historic project of European integration, born in the wake of the Second World War, an accomplishment that has brought unprecedented prosperity and stability to a continent that had all too often known war, would be placed at risk. Also at risk would be the so-called special relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom, often America's closest and most important partner and ally in the world. But even if Brexit, or the worst of it, is somehow avoided, that it garnered the support it did in a country such as the United Kingdom tells us that there are fewer givens in the world than many of us, indeed most of us, assumed. Populism and nationalism are on the rise. What we are witnessing is a widespread rejection of globalization and international involvement and, as a result, a questioning of long-standing postures and policies, from openness to trade and immigrants to a willingness to maintain alliances and overseas commitments. This questioning is by no means limited to Great Britain. There are signs of it throughout Europe, in the United States, and nearly everywhere else. All this is a far cry from the optimism and confidence that were just as widespread a quarter of a century before. One source of this mood was the fall of the Berlin Wall on November 9, 1989, 11-9 of all days, an event that heralded the peaceful and successful demise of the Cold War, the unprecedented struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union that had defined much of international relations for the four decades following the end of the Second World War. This was followed less than a year later by a remarkable coming together of the world to turn back Saddam Hussein's effort to conquer Kuwait, something that would have had enormous consequences if it had been allowed to stand. The administration of George Herbert Walker Bush, the 41st President of the United States, saw what Iraq had done and its likely consequences, not just in immediate and local terms, but also historically, as the opening event of the post-Cold War era. The President and those around him, including me, then a special assistant to the President and the principal advisor for the Middle East, Persian Gulf, and South Asia on the National Security Council staff, saw developments as constituting a precedent that could well give the new geopolitical era its character. Depending on what was done in response to Saddam's aggression and act of conquest, the post-Cold War world could be one of international order or disorder on a large scale. It was thus for reasons both local and global, direct and indirect, that the United States did what it did and in the way it did it. Toward that end, the United States worked closely with the other 14 members of the United Nations Security Council to repudiate Iraq's aggression and to establish and subsequently enforce a sanctions regime designed to ensure that Iraq would not benefit from its conquest and would pay an enormous price for it. A large coalition of dozens of countries contributing in different ways was built to make sure Iraqi aggression did not threaten Saudi Arabia, and when diplomacy backed by sanctions failed to dislodge Iraq from Kuwait, to force Iraq out of that country and to restore Kuwait's independence and government. The policy succeeded for the most part, and both Bush and his National Security Advisor, Brent Scowcroft, spoke of their hope that the collective effort to reverse Iraqi aggression and restore Kuwaiti sovereignty would set a precedent for what would follow. This was something the President highlighted in his September 1990 address to a joint session of Congress. The crisis in the Persian Gulf, as grave as it is, also offers a rare opportunity to move toward an historic period of cooperation. Out of these troubled times, a new world order can emerge, a new era, freer from the threat of terror, stronger in the pursuit of justice, and more secure in the quest for peace. An era in which the nations of the world, East and West, North and South, can prosper and live in harmony. 100 generations have searched for this elusive path to peace, while 1,000 wars raged across the span of human endeavor. Today, that new world is struggling to be born, a world quite different from the one we've known, a world where the rule of law supplants the rule of the jungle, a world in which nations recognize the shared responsibility for freedom and justice, a world where the strong respect the rights of the weak. This is the vision that I shared with Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev in Helsinki. He and other leaders from Europe, the Gulf, and around the world understand that how we manage this crisis today could shape the future for generations to come. Now, some 25 years later, it is clear that no benign New World Order materialized. What exists in many parts of the world, as well as in various venues of international relations, resembles more a New World disorder. If there were a publicly traded stock called World Order Incorporated, it would not have crashed, but it would have suffered a correction, losing at least 10% of its value. The world might even be entering bear market territory, something normally associated with a fall of 20%. What is worse, no rally is in sight. To the contrary, the trend is one of declining order. This is not to deny the existence of important examples of stability and progress in the world, including an absence of great power conflict, a degree of international cooperation managing some of the challenges associated with globalization, and considerable coordination among governments and institutions in regard to many aspects of international economic policy. There is as well the fact that more people than ever are leading longer and healthier lives, that hundreds of millions of men, women and children have been lifted out of extreme poverty, and that more people enjoy what can be termed a middle-class life than at any other time in history. Indeed, there is a body of writing that argues just this. We are better off than the apostles of doom and gloom would have you believe. Or to paraphrase that old saw about Wagner's music being better than it sounds, the world is better than it looks. As attractive as this
sample complete. Ready to continue?